This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Chicago Police Department has systematically used excessive force. That's according to a report released last month by the U.S. Justice Department. The report outlines how police force has violated civil rights of citizens and that the abuse is most prevalent in predominantly black neighborhoods on Chicago's South and West sides. The report came as the result of a controversial shooting of teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014. The unarmed black teenager was shot 16 times, and the whole incident was captured on a dash camera. But the Laquan McDonald story was not always well known to the public. In fact, it first came to light by investigative reporter Jamie Calvin months after the incident. After receiving an inside tip, Jamie tracked down Laquan McDonald's autopsy, which revealed the police were not telling the whole truth. Jamie Calvin is an investigative reporter and human rights activist who spent much of his career reporting on patterns of police misconduct in Chicago. His work paved the way for a transformative legal decision that establishes that all police disciplinary records in the state of Illinois are indeed public information. His reporting also uncovered surprising details about the code of silence within the Chicago Police Department. Jamie Calvin is at Duke University this week. He's going to be speaking at Duke's Gross Hall tonight at 6:30, but first joins me in the studio. Jamie Calvin, what a pleasure. Welcome.
It's good to be with you.
This work of yours that I've just talked about, much of it stemmed from experiences you had when you immersed yourself in public housing, a public housing community called Stateway Gardens. Tell us how you got involved and what you saw there.
Yeah, so I should first set the scene for people who don't know Chicago and Chicago during that era.
Which is the 1990s.
The 1990s. So the mid-1990s, I began this work. And Chicago had, on the south side, the biggest concentration of public housing in the country, which was also the biggest concentration of poverty. I think you could think of it as being like Soweto and Johannesburg. I mean, a township, a city within the city. And it was a fascinating phenomena. On South State Street, there were several miles of high-rise public housing developments, Robert Taylor Homes, Stateway Gardens, where I was concentrated for well over a decade, immersed for well over a decade. And by the time these developments were built, they were built in what had been the old black belt of the city, created by the Great Migration from the South in the 50s and 60s. By the time I began to work there in the 90s, they were utterly abandoned. Stateway Gardens, where I worked, which constituted about 8 square blocks of the South Side. I'm really talking New Jack City. I mean, completely embattled, controlled by two major gangs at the time. On the basis of the 1990 census, a political scientist determined that it was the single poorest neighborhood in America. They probably had a lot of competition, in truth, but looking at census tracts. Mm-hmm. So this was the setting in which, I mean, I've been a writer throughout my career, but I have had a sort of second career, really, I think, as a citizen more than anything else, engaged in social initiatives around the South Side. And that sort of trajectory carried me to Stateway, and I worked there for a number of years. I worked creating a program intended to generate alternatives for young men in the criminal economy and the gangs. I was an advisor to the resident leadership, but it provided a sort of unique immersion and access to a set of conditions that have been really foundational for my reporting since. You know, in the course of that, the year, I witnessed on an almost daily basis patterns of policing that were so discontinuous with what I was used to. I live in about a mile and a half away from that South State Street corridor, which no longer exists, having been demolished. Mm-hmm. In an integrated neighborhood, President Obama and Michelle Obama's house is several blocks away. And my expectations of policing were so different from what I was seeing from day to day, and extended from, on a spectrum, from just, casual, ugly incivility, use of the N-word, just, you know, that kind of ugliness to an extreme. I investigated a homicide by the police. I investigated rape. There were coerced confessions that can only be described as being exacted by torture. So a whole spectrum of things, and what and everything in between, including a great deal of just daily corruption. I haven't made clear that the these were essentially vice zones. This is where people bought drugs, could come to buy drugs. So the question that formed, and I wrote a great deal over those years documenting what I saw, and the question that formed that really has driven my reporting since is, having seen these things, and, you know, I'm a professional observer, really documenting them, what set of institutional arrangements, how would the world have to be organized for what I know to be true, because I've seen it, documented it, witnessed it, to be the case? And that's really kind of where my more recent investigations took off from.
So let's talk about how that looked from the ground level for the people who lived and had to work through. What was their interpretation of what was happening? Clearly, this was happening to them every day.
It was happening to them every day. I mean, nobody would make a 911 call in a community such as Stateway Gardens with any expectation that the police would come. To the extent that the police were a presence, they were focused on the open-air sort of drug trade that took place in the lobbies of the buildings, these sort of open-air lobbies. Mm-hmm. And so the police would come periodically and hit the buildings, you know, charge in. Very often, they, on a daily basis, you would see police come, take drugs and money off the young men, and not make arrests. So, you know, there's a kind of, the residents would joke about the areas where the drug dealing took place in each of the buildings, as a policeman's ATM machine. You know, you're late on your house note, you just come and get some money off one of these young men and say, you know, you're bailing out here.
Well, so the impact, so their sense of what the criminal justice system meant for them was not at all what you and I
were. Huge frustration. And also as much as residents might deplore the drug trade, and they did not demonize these young men. I mean, they knew them in other contexts. It was so-and-so's son, it was your classmate, but huge frustration. Who wants to? And they had to come and go through the open marketplace. I established an office in one of the buildings, and if you came to visit me there in those years, you would have been ushered in by drug dealers acting as sort of doormen. So nobody wants to live in conditions like that, and yet their complaints, their demands for better service were unavailing.
I'm talking today with Jamie Calvin on the state of things. He's an investigative reporter, founder of the Invisible Institute. Largely because of his reporting, we know what we know about one particular case and many others in the city of Chicago uncovering corruption there and the code of silence. We're talking about all that today. You actually began working with lawyers to bring legal representation to people with development, right?
Right. So I formed a collaboration with lawyers at the University of Chicago Law School at the legal clinic, and we've been working together now for 14 years. It's been incredibly productive. And so in those years at Stateway, I think half a dozen federal civil rights suits were brought, some of them arising out of my reporting. And they also enriched my reporting because we learned things through the lawsuits. The culminating lawsuit, the name of it was Bond versus Utreras, the name of an officer, culminated many years later. It sort of morphed into another case in which I was the principal plaintiff, Calvin versus Chicago. And that's the case that established the principle that, subject to reasonable redaction, an officer's home address, things like that, documents bearing on allegations of police misconduct are public information. So we have effectively, I mean, it took many years, but we've effectively in Illinois broken down the wall of official secrecy around this. And that's made possible, you know, some of the answers, at least at a statistical level, to the question that's been driving us. I mean, how can this happen? How can this be? And so I urge your listeners, if they're interested, we've presented all of this information, something called the Citizens Police Data Project. Google it, you'll readily find it, and which has proved really useful in the Chicago setting. Everybody uses it now.
And what does it do? What do we have? By the way, we have a link to it at our website,
statedthings.org. Yeah, great. So people should take a look at it, because I know the same level of transparency does not prevail in North Carolina. But we can provide the disciplinary histories of officers going back in time. Ultimately, we're going to have information all the way back to the late 60s.
Police have said, look, the pushback is this is dangerous for cops. You shouldn't put this out there. It puts their lives, already a dangerous job, in greater danger.
And I think the experience, and we've certainly heard those arguments, and in litigation over the years, you know, all sorts of horribles were invoked, that officers and their families would be harassed, that officers would be assassinated, targeted. Nothing of that nature has happened. What has happened, and it's a major watershed, is now the debate over police reform in Chicago takes place with the same evidentiary basis. We're all talking about the same facts. And one of the, you know, official secrecy degrades our ability as citizens in that we don't have information we need to be fully effective. But it's also a rhetorical tool. You know, think of Dick Cheney or somebody like that. If you knew what I know, right, you would know I'm doing the right thing. Well, all sorts of arguments about policing take that form.
We are talking today with Jamie Calvin, an investigative reporter and the founder of the Invisible Institute. It's a journalistic production company on the south side of Chicago, and it has reported extensively on patterns of police misconduct. He's going to be speaking tonight at Duke University's Gross Hall, 6:30. We have more information about that, the database, and other information at our website, stateofthings.org, and our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Jamie Calvin, an investigative reporter and human rights activist who has reported extensively on police misconduct in the Chicago Police Department. He is visiting Keenan practitioner in residence at Duke and will be speaking tonight at Gross Hall. We have information at our website, stateofthings.org. We also have a link to the Citizens Police Data Project, which you talked about before the break, which has the disciplinary records of police officers.
Right. So we have now what is the largest interactive database with this kind of information, and notably it includes the names of officers. And you know there was, in the back and forth and litigation that led to the public being able to access this information, there were lots of dangers invoked by the police union and the city in terms of, you know, collateral damage, but nothing of that nature has happened.
Like risks to police officers.
Risks to police officers. Nothing of that nature has happened. And I think for North Carolina and other jurisdictions, the Chicago history is really useful to push off from in arguing for greater transparency. What has been disclosed by having this information in public is the extraordinary degree to which the city of Chicago and the police department have had no interest in translating a kind of information that, you know, if you were a corporation and had this kind of information about, these are citizen complaints, tens of thousands of citizen complaints about their interactions, about encounters and interactions with the police, you know, for a corporation, having this kind of information would be quality control. It would affect your bottom line, your efficacy as an institution. What we've been able to demonstrate in analyzing this body of material is the degree to which what really has existed until recently was a kind of system for not knowing things they were capable of knowing, not connecting the dots, not looking for patterns. When you do that, it becomes apparent that it's extraordinarily unlikely that any allegation of abuse will ever be sustained by the investigative bodies, you know, within the police department and within the city, and that if sustained, there's an infinitesimal chance that the officer will receive any meaningful punishment. So what that means is it's like a portrait of impunity, you know, a lack of fear of punishment.
Forgive me for interrupting, but it suggests a kind of that this results from a sort of willful neglect. But there is aggressive pushback the minute you bring a charge, and maybe the Laquan McDonald case, I think, is probably a pretty good example.
Well, you know, Laquan McDonald is really the sort of watershed event in Chicago. And I first heard the name. So on October 20th, 2014, media in Chicago reported, and the next day they reported, based on a press release that came from the police, that a 17-year-old boy had been killed that night by police officers. He had lunged at the police with a knife, and the officer had, in defense of himself and his fellow officers, shot the young man in the chest, and he died sometime later. Now, in any American city, you read stories like this often. And I've spent my whole, you know, professional career in Chicago, and I can't count the hundreds of thousands of such stories I've read, sometimes with some uneasiness, you know, some uneasiness. And then even in my case, an investigative journalist immersed on the South Side, you turn the page. And I remember reading the Laquan McDonald reporting. There was something a little bit anomalous. Kid with a knife, he ends up dead. Not quite, you know, but there was not a lot of detail. Turned the page. And it was a week or so later that a colleague I worked closely with, a civil rights lawyer, got a call from a whistleblower high within law enforcement, somebody we both knew, with the information that what had been reported was not at all what had happened, that the case was horrific, that there was video, that video existed, and that he was really doubtful that his own agency would investigate it. So he was reaching out. And we had been in the media a lot because of the case and because of my reporting. And so that kind of launched my investigative journey in trying to find out what happened. And I won't go into all the, you know, all the detail, but the really critical thing to establish is that as of the time, some 5 or 6 hours after the incident, that the city put out a press release under the letterhead of the superintendent. As of that time, they had all the information we now have about what really happened. And what really happened was a young man with a knife kind of wandering around in a disassociated state provokes a 911 call. The initial responders to the call handle the situation flawlessly. They walk with the young man. He does not respond to a request to drop the knife. They don't push the issue. There are no civilians. There's nobody on the street who's threatened. It's a kind of industrial area at night. They accompany him, one officer on foot with a flashlight next to the boy, the other in a squad car.
May I stop you for a moment? Because this evidence is based on video surveillance. So this is not a written report. You can see
this
happening.
I can actually see it. There's a big building. Yep. I'm not sure this has ever been published. I'm co-producing a documentary about this incident. We're going to use this footage. There's footage from the Chicago Food Depository, which is a huge building that occupies a whole block of the city, and it has exterior surveillance cameras. And remember, it's fall, it's October. It's actually a kind of a beautiful, weirdly beautiful bit of film and shocking compared to what happens next, sort of through your perspective is through the leaves on trees. And you see what is really a kind of image of care. The officers accompanying this young man. He's walking purposefully on the sidewalk, nothing agitated or aggressive about his demeanor. In fact, they're walking him to his death because they get to the intersection of 41st Street and Pulaski Road in Chicago. Another officer, Jason Van Dyke, just appearing on the scene, within 30 seconds of getting out of his vehicle, opens fire on the young man. And what the video doesn't capture that the world has now seen, but I was told by civilian witnesses to the shooting, and this is when I was kind of all in on the story. You know, you approach a story like this sort of by degrees. But I found a civilian witness who told me that he had an unimpeded view, a motorist who was stopped by the action and had an unimpeded view, that what was so strange and about the whole incident was the first shot or shots took the young man to the ground. And he's kind of, as we all know from the video, writhing in pain and sort of in fetal position. And then there's an extended pause, after which the barrage comes, a total of 16 independent gunshot wounds. When I heard that from the civilian witness, I knew that, and he was completely credible, that this was a story that had to be told. But the point I want to really emphasize is that as the city put out the press release, they knew everything. They had multiple police and civilian witnesses. They had the video. They knew they had the video. The autopsy wasn't performed until the next morning at 8:30. But it doesn't take very long to count to 16.
Right.
So all that information was available. They put out a false narrative, which then required, and this really goes to the code of silence theme. Code of silence does have to do with silence. Officers who are intimidated to speak out, citizens who are silent because they feel like it won't gain them anything to complain. But it's really more about narrative control. And so having put out this patently false narrative, they had to do all sorts of things, destroy evidence, intimidate witnesses, falsify official reports, stonewall the press, withhold public information from the public. And then the culmination was once lawyers for the family were able, through a circuitous process, to get a hold of the video, a $5 million settlement with the family to keep the video from coming out. So this was I have an almost visceral sense of it as a reporter doing this story and other kindred stories. You can almost feel as a gravitational force the huge investment of the city in maintaining the official narrative. Where the official narrative blew up is, and it was long before the video came out, is when I was able to secure the autopsy. Because their story was essentially young man. I mean, the subtext of the official story was young man causes his own death. He was the agent of his own death.
Right, refused.
Once you see 16 shots.
Well, and of course, the insidious and the more brutal thing about all of this is this cover-up, which suggests that the cover-up of these kinds had been going on for a long time, and that creates this condition in which officers act with impunity, and those who would love to clean up the department, for whom this does not represent why they became a police officer or any part of how they see their policing, they can't. They cannot open their mouths.
They can't open their mouths. And the I think the way to think about it is this is an institution, and I won't generalize beyond Chicago. That's what I know, and that's what I've investigated and reported on. But I suspect in varying degrees this is true in all, at least major urban police departments. The current culture in policing is such that you have to be really extraordinarily heroic to break ranks, to fulfill your oath, to report criminal activity by other officers. And an institution, it used to be said of totalitarianism, that an institution in which you have to be a hero to be decent, to be a good neighbor, to is a profoundly dysfunctional institution. So if you were doing a biopsy of policing in America, I think the functioning of the code of silence is just a central pathology.
And maybe what puts a point on this is that you talked about the initial responding officers in Laquan McDonald's case doing the right thing.
Yeah.
They did not feel threatened. They understood that this was somebody perhaps with a disability. They were trying to calm it down. Ultimately, they had to side with the officers. And now they're facing prosecution because they were part of the cover-up when initially they wanted to do the right thing.
Right. And I think for me that's a really poignant part of the story. So the initial responders who handled the case as we would want our police to handle such a situation. I mean, it is a law enforcement situation. You've got a seemingly disturbed young man with a knife, albeit a 3-inch folding knife. That's a law enforcement situation. You want an intervention at that point. They handle it appropriately. They then witness an atrocity, and I don't know these officers, but I can easily imagine that they were as appalled as either of us would be at what they saw and as shocked. And they go back to the station house, and the way the code of silence operates is a supervising officer, their sergeant, lieutenant, captain, tells them, this is how we're going to handle it. This is what you're going to say in your report. So you've just witnessed an atrocity, and the kind of your de facto job description requires that you lie about it. I can't imagine, I really can't imagine worse working conditions. And I think, you know, as we go forward in Chicago and nationally with the discourse about police reform, we have to extend some imaginative sympathy to the police, you know, who are often seen in a purely negative light in this. Police reform has to work for police officers as well as for the general public.
Well, and it on the streets, I mean, you have talked with young people on the south side of Chicago to try to get a sense of their everyday interactions, what that looks like if you're an African-American male or female who lives in those neighborhoods. What's it like for you to see the police? And here's a sample of what you heard.
You can't even hang out no more. That's how, like, if they see you as a group, they stop you.
Every time I get off the bus, I have to walk down 74th, and it's some, like, depending on what time I make it, it'll be a police car or two passing. So I try to put my head down and play my phone, you know, so they can keep going.
It's like restricting. You can't do stuff that regular people would, because it's like you're being harassed.
I try not to have any run-ins with the police, because I don't know how they're going to hop out the car or how many people are actually in the car or how their day has been going. Because, you know, like, if they're having a bad day, they can easily just take it out on you because they're the police.
It makes you want to change your routes. It makes you scared to walk past the police because you don't know what they're going to say.
Was a clip from the Youth Police Project that documents relationships between teenagers on Chicago's South Side and the police department, part of the work of the Invisible Institute. And I'm here talking with the Institute's founder, Jamie Calvin, today on the state of things. You hear that kind of evidence, and then you talk about the cover-up and how high up it goes. We talked about a court case in which the kind of police abuse was proven in court. And the judge found that this code of silence was a serious problem and included that in the judgment. And talk about the city's response to that judgment.
Well, it's an interesting history around the code of silence. I'd like to just say a word about the voices we heard. This is a project we've been engaged in for, we're in our fifth year now, of really intensive engagement with young people on the South Side about their interactions with the police. And we spent a whole year with groups of students, high school students, juniors and seniors, talking with them. And we don't ask them about the worst thing that ever happened, Laquan McDonald. It's the day-to-day stuff, the random stops. And I think you hear in those voices something that is not often visible in our discourse about these things, because we focus on the shootings, we focus on the wrongful conviction, all serious harms. But there are harms that are being accrued from day to day. On an unbelievable scale, these are young people, you know, teenagers who should be exploring the city, expanding their boundaries, and they are required to self-police to a degree that I think has to be seen as just a grave loss of freedom, where you and I can walk down the street and be in our thoughts, and they walk down the street and are calculating constantly. Put aside all the gang dynamics in some of their neighborhoods, when the police are a harassing rather than a protective presence.
And their cynicism about that, which is well earned, about the system itself, makes policing that much more difficult. So they have to do it. And I think, sadly, I've got 3 minutes left, but I want to point to your code of silence, four-part series, which is an incredible piece of journalism that talks about a completely different case where there was a racket run by a police officer. It included homicide and shakedowns and sort of every form of police corruption. And two officers tried to make the report, and you talk about the discrimination and the abuse and persecution that they felt. The one point I want to make again, and I want you to follow up,
these were two good cops who actually had very successful because they were honest. They were very right. successful because they didn't lie to, they didn't shake people down. They right. didn't take their drugs and give it to somebody else. And everybody on the street knew that.
Yep.
And they had incredible success being good cops doing just that.
Right. And I think that we need to, so somebody once said, and I urge people to read the piece. It's on a publication, The Intercept. It's called The Code of Silence. Easy to find.
And you can, we'll link to it at stateofthings.org. Yeah.
But, you know, it, what you're reminding me of is a statement that a friend of mine made years ago, and she's now Deputy Commissioner of Police in New York, Susan Herman, and she said, and I think it kind of is a good note to end on, she said, in a democracy, there's nothing as good as a good police officer, and there's nothing as bad police officer. I mean, this is a critical, critical function in our democracy. I mean, we're really talking, as when we talk about these issues, about the fundamental character of our society. And we, as we do that, we need to fully assess and confront the degree of harm that can be caused by a relatively small number of officers if they're allowed to operate with impunity. But we also need to remember what good police officers look like and how critically important they are.
Investigative journalist Jamie Calvin, founder of The Invisible Institute, a journalistic production company that reports extensively on patterns of police abuse and misconduct in Chicago and brings those things to light. Jamie, thanks for your work and thanks for being here.
It's been my pleasure.
Jamie Calvin is at Duke University this week, going to speak at Duke's Gross Hall tonight at 6:30. We have more information and links to all of the pieces we were talking about at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk with an author who examined the life after the nuclear war, a nuclear attack on Nagasaki, and the effect it had on five people. That on the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.